Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Dr. Robert Wallace, chair of the Institute of Medicine Committee on Living Well with Chronic Disease. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare looks at an implantable camera that travels through the bloodstream. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Each year, 6.3 million pregnant women and newborns die from pregnancy and complications of childbirth, and 99% of these deaths occur in developing countries where women receive little or no prenatal care. Engineering students at Johns Hopkins University have developed an inexpensive solution that can cheaply and easily save lives. The problem facing expectant mothers in the third world? Even a 50-cent dipstick to test for certain conditions is too expensive. The students, responding to a challenge from the U.S. Agency for International Development, developed what they call a magic marker that, when run over a tiny urine sample on a piece of paper, can simply and easily detect a variety of potential conditions. To simplify it further, the markers were color-coded for testing for specific problems. And the best part, anyone can be taught how to use the markers, which cost about a third of a penny for use, a dramatic cost savings for those using the system. An international aid organization is so excited about the new device, it's being tested on a group of expectant mothers in Nepal. They say this invention is poised to make a big impact on maternal and infant health around the globe. A simple magic marker that can cheaply test for prenatal problems to reduce maternal and infant mortality? Now that's a bright idea.
Today, Margaret and I are speaking with Dr. Robert Wallace of the Institute of Medicine, chair of the Committee on Living Well with Chronic Disease, which just released a report on the need for public health policy directives to combat this growing problem. Dr. Wallace, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Good afternoon.
Your committee was charged by the Center for Disease Control to undertake an interesting public health investigation to look at the toll chronic illness is exacting on individuals, on their families and communities, and ultimately on the health and well-being of the nation. But you note in the report that you talk about how the population over 65 will reach 70 million by 2030, and 37 million will be managing more than one chronic disease. Your group identified 9 so-called exemplar conditions that pose the greatest threat to the long-term public health. Talk to me about these.
The burden of chronic illness is well known and well described, and while we did document some of this, in fact, the goal of this report was actually to try to point directions where public health can have a greater impact on persons who already have chronic illness. Public health has spent much of its time, as it should, trying to prevent diseases from happening in the first place, whether they be acute infectious diseases or chronic illnesses such as cancer, heart disease, stroke, and so on. So because public health has had many effective triumphs and still lots of challenges as well for the primary prevention of disease, the fact that the population is aging, and not merely persons over 65, but it's an older population, and people are living longer with a variety of chronic illnesses. Many of them are doing well with them, but many are not. And there are really a diverse number of chronic illnesses. So the underlying purpose of the report was to try to see how public health can reach further to help persons who have chronic illness. Now, much of the burden of chronic illness actually begins with the healthcare system, and nobody really quibbles with that. But healthcare, the primary healthcare system certainly has not been able to meet all of the challenges either for a variety of reasons. CDC wanted us to look at the public side of this and see what health departments could do to help people with chronic illness, not to substitute for what the healthcare system does, but to try to make its contribution to either preventing the complications of disease or mitigating them in whatever ways are possible.
Dr. Wallace, I agree that the public has gotten a handle in recent years on the cost to the healthcare system of chronic illness and chronic diseases. I think it's only a little more recently that people are beginning to understand the toll it takes on individuals themselves and on the society, and certainly I think fairly recently out of Health Affairs and some other publications, there's been more attention devoted to costs in terms of lifetime educational achievement, lifetime financial achievement, lifetime family achievement based on the presence of a chronic illness and trying to, as you so eloquently say, live well with it. Maybe you could talk with our listeners a little more about this social cost of trying to live with chronic illness in our country.
So there are a lot of social costs of illness other than the actual economic costs. When somebody in a family is ill, it has an impact on other members of the family. And we spend a lot of time looking at illnesses of different kinds and different patterns and so forth, because each of them behaves differently. For example, an example of a social cost might be somebody who's had a cancer of one sort or another, and then, as far as one can tell clinically, is cured. But that person will become a cancer survivor, and that will take a psychological cost, that will take a social cost, that may have an impact on employment or future plans. And so these social costs can run in any direction. If somebody is living with a chronic illness, that may impair the ability to get a job or to get insurance. And all of these weigh on individuals, on families, and on communities.
Dr. Wallace, as the title of the report suggests, you didn't just look at the need for managing these chronic illnesses. You state that there should be public policies initiated from the top down, from the Center for Disease Control and Health and Human Services, right down to the local community directives for living well with chronic diseases. Could you elaborate a little more on that for us?
Sure. So illnesses take a toll of one sort or another, and we wish we could make them all go away, but given that we can't do that, it's important to really have optimal health and optimal function as best we can for everyone with chronic illness. The way the communities and policies can help with that is to ease the burdens of living and functioning with chronic illness. I mean, a great example of an existing policy is the Americans with Disabilities Act. So not all chronic illnesses are physically disabling, mm-hmm. but for those that are, it's great for persons with those illnesses to be able to get into buildings and navigate the world is in a much better way. So I think that's a really great example of policies.
Tell us, are there other recommendations that you were making as a committee about reducing the health disparities and the outcome of chronic illness?
Well, with respect to health disparities, we certainly spent a lot of time highlighting that this is still an important issue, that these disparities by age, by ethnic status, and so forth, are not going away and need special attention. And because we're a set of diverse cultures in this country, programs need to be tailored to these two different cultures. And I think everyone appreciates that. We also paid some attention to mental illness, which is so important to this. And when one thinks of chronic illness, perhaps mental illness doesn't jump to the top. But we wanted to be certain that we looked at disparities and other issues with respect to that as well. In fact, we commissioned a chapter in our report that actually looks at the effect of physical chronic illnesses on depression, on the genesis of depression, which is a really important problem across a wide range of illnesses. One of the things that you also said that I want to highlight at this moment is that I'm not responsible for all of this. I had a great committee and a great staff working with me at the Institute of Medicine, and they are all responsible for this. Mm-hmm. And yes, many of them are very experienced and have made many contributions in their own right, and it was a pleasure to work with all of them.
We're speaking with Dr. Robert Wallace, chair of the Institute of Medicine's Committee on Living Well with Chronic Disease, which just released its report calling for public health action on chronic disease in this country. Dr. Walsh, your report suggests that there need to be far-reaching policy directives to attack the problem of chronic illness, which you warn is already reaching crisis levels. But programs need to be designed and implemented. Describe some of the programs you'd like to see that would have a positive impact on the prevention of illness, as well as improving the quality of life for chronically ill. Can you discuss with us what it will take to get some of these programs in place?
We think the Affordable Care Act may be one vehicle, but in fact, as the healthcare industry consolidates, it very much needs to find ways to develop services and education and self-management tools for its patient. On the other hand, there are lots of things that can be done in the community that, in fact, should be done that aren't necessarily connected to the healthcare system. And, in fact, there is an argument that once a patient is given guidance and repeated guidance when he or she needs that, self-management is really an individual and a family trying to figure out how best to live with that illness themselves and to find the mechanisms that work for them. And so there's always individual and family. In terms of policies, one of the directions that we recommended was for the Department of Health and Human Services and CDC was to take a more active stance with respect to health in all policies. Okay, so that's a catchphrase. And fundamentally what that means is that government agencies and other large organizations make policies that are not directly related to health or health care and yet have an impact on health. There may be important decisions being made in other public sectors that have an impact on persons with chronic illness, and that needs to be attended and to as best as possible anticipated.
Dr. Wells, I'm curious either geographically whether there were communities or organizations that you thought really represented some tremendous advances in how we're approaching this issue of living well or even whole states. And maybe a part B of that question, if I could, we recently had the opportunity to talk with the founder of People Like Me, who made the point very clearly, as we all know, you know, patients may come and see us four times a year, but they live with their chronic illness every day of the year, and therefore social media and some of the online programs that have developed around support for living with chronic illness have become more common. What did your committee think of along those lines or look at?
We talked to an awful lot of people representing not only certain conditions, but important conditions, but also organizations approaching the social side of this, such as supporting caregivers. So we didn't really try to identify individual programs that do things best, because best in one community is not necessarily the same as another. We certainly came across many programs that do a very good job at what they do. And one of the jobs of public health is to be certain that people who have chronic illness have access to these programs, because for various reasons, not everybody does. So that's one of the challenges that comes with public health. With respect to online social communities and other approaches to this, most of these are not sponsored by government agencies, and we think in general they're a good thing. They're self-help and group help, been around for a long time. The internet has, of course, raised this to a new level and has enabled a kind of communication that otherwise people won't have. At some point, they need to be evaluated. We didn't look at those programs specifically, but we welcome any reasonable approach to trying to give people information and communication.
Dr. Wallace, the report suggests that the current healthcare system has not pursued in any comprehensive way incentives aligned to community-based organizations and public health and developing structures for prevention and management of chronic diseases, and that the current approach is fragmented and costly. How can we do a better job at changing the healthcare system approaches, and maybe some specifics? Patient-centered medical homes or accountable care organizations or maybe community health workers might be some good examples.
Well, those are all examples. And basically, in the end, in the last chapter of the report, we made a plea for alignment of the healthcare system and the public health system. You used the word fragmented, and I think that's probably correct. we need to bring everybody to the table. We suggested that one of the roles of CDC and the state health departments is to catalyze the community organizations working with the healthcare system. It's a very difficult and sometimes even painful process as to who's going to do what and who needs what and who has the resources and so forth. But in the end, it's a case of strategic planning and alignment between healthcare systems and where public health can make contributions.
You know, we're emphasizing public health and prevention quite a bit in our conversation. Dr. Wallace, and what's your sense of how we're going to fund these efforts? Is there adequate funding under the Affordable Care Act? Do you predict we'll need a new type of funding or a new source of funding to be able to accomplish some of these objectives at the community and the state as well as the federal level?
The fate of the prevention funds that are in the Affordable Care Act is up in the air, and people are looking at that. And that's a political process that we didn't address. We can only hope that these funds will go where they're intended by the Congress, because we think, in fact, they're really needed. In the end, the healthcare system will have to make contributions through its usual funding stream. So will public health, and so will all the voluntary agencies that have a role in all of this. First of all, you have the usual sorts of primary prevention that public health does well in the community, teaching anti-tobacco practices in the schools, quit lines, and that sort of thing. So there's a need for primary prevention for everybody. Then once chronic illness supervenes, one needs to have several kinds of prevention. First of all, you need all of the preventives for everything other than the condition that you have. So if you have chronic inflammation, you still might need cancer prevention and cholesterol levels and all of the other things that we do that we know that works. And then on top of that, you have preventives to try the best that one can to mitigate and prevent the progression of the illness and sometimes even cure it. And then as for those individuals where their chronic illness advances, there are all kinds of tertiary problems that occur with that cut across individual illnesses. People fall, they get drug reactions, they get depressed. And working on preventing those kinds of long-term distal problems that people with chronic illness have is also a challenge. And sometimes even the research and methods aren't up for it, but they're all there. And so there really is a great need for prevention at all kinds of levels. And again, I can only hope that those funds will stay where they belong.
You say public health surveillance is an important element to managing chronic illness across broad spectrums, and yet there's still a lack of a unified platform for sharing medical data. And based on conversations we've had here on the show with Anish Chopra and Senator Daschle, we seem to be progressing in that direction, but it's sort of at a snail's pace, although the VA has some pretty notable success with the Blue Button Initiative. Tell us why the need for broad-based data sharing is so important here, and are there any other modes of population data collection that look promising?
The electronic medical record and the ability to transfer those records around the country and follow individuals when they go to different healthcare systems seems to be a ways off. But I think it's represents a set of technologies that can be done. It's a question of working through, first of all, the costs. Second of all, you want to make certain that the information in electronic medical records is right. But I think we're moving in the right direction, and it's just going to take some time to make it work. But once good interoperative universal medical record is available on everybody, and certainly that individuals and patients have access to their own records, which I think is really important to all of this, then I think it'll be easier to understand where the needs are in chronic illness, and will make for better strategies and better outcomes.
Dr. Wallace, about maybe 15 months or so ago, there was a different Institute of Medicine committee, and they issued their report on the future of nursing. And I remember there was a very kind of clear dynamic follow-up to that, coalitions organized in states across the country by region. What would you expect to see or hope to see happening as this now moves to the level of state commissioners of health, district health directors, local communities? What do you think will happen there?
Chronic disease control programs are basically in place in almost all states. They're there, they're in place, they don't have enough resources to do everything. And so we asked, one of our recommendations was to ask them to do strategic planning that can certainly include and must include other health professionals beside physicians. Nurses are a very, very important part of all of this. So are social workers, so are community health workers. And again, I think communities will pick their priorities and do their programs in different ways. But I think this this is happening at all levels. It's partly a grassroots movement. It's partly a voluntary movement. It's partly a health professional movement, and certainly a public health movement. And then on top of all of this, we made several recommendations on how to better do surveillance of chronic illness. That is, how to monitor communities in terms of what's how many people really have illness, what's wrong with them, what are the trajectories of those illnesses. And we hope by doing that, looking at acute infectious diseases, that this will now turn in a fuller way to surveying the communities for chronic illness occurrence and outcomes, and that will help each community plan its activities in a better way.
Dr. Wallace, we'd like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and the world, what else do you see in terms of innovations, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
I think there are a number of things that are happening. We think that doing surveillance with medical records, and so we don't have to do telephone surveys and that sort of thing, will be important. I'm also hoping that healthcare systems will do more planning for prevention. And I think in many ways, personalized medicine, that is using biomarkers and metabolic markers and genetics and all of the tools that are emerging now, will also be important, because it will enable us to target individuals for various kinds of prevention and mitigation more fully than we've ever been able to do that before.
Today, we've been speaking with Dr. Robert Wallace, chair of the Institute of Medicine's Committee on Living Well with Chronic Disease. Dr. Wallace, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations today.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with this tech report. It's been 50 years since Raquel Welch and Stephen Boyd were shrunken down to travel inside the body of a diplomat in the 1960s cult classic Fantastic Voyage.
The medieval philosophers were right. Man is the center of the universe. We stand in the middle of infinity, between outer and inner space. And there's no limit to either.
I never imagined it could be anything like this.
But engineering researchers at Stanford University have unveiled a modern-day version of that film's premise, an implantable camera that can travel remotely inside the bloodstream, powered by radio waves.
For you are going where no man or camera has ventured before.
Stanford researcher Ada Poon has cracked a barrier scientists have been trying to tackle for decades: how to make the implantable camera device small enough to travel through the entire bloodstream and yet power it in a way that would allow the device to work. Based on previous math models, the device, controlled by electromagnetic radio waves, would have needed a longer antenna to receive the right frequency to power the device through human tissue and bone. Poon and her team conducted experiments on the conductivity of human tissue and bone and developed new math for the type of radio frequency required, one that allowed them to keep the device small enough to travel unencumbered through the bloodstream. Poon sees this discovery as a first step in revolutionizing medical technology. No batteries to wear out, no cables to corrode. While human tests are still down the road, applications include everything from diagnostics to minimally invasive surgeries. Suddenly, the premise of Fantastic Voyage doesn't seem so far-fetched.
Four men and a beautiful girl, off on a fantastic voyage, actually entering inside the human body.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with this tech report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is a Connecting Our Communities initiative from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.